As part of our ongoing search for finding religious meaning in Lag BaOmer, we will talk today about Jewish unity. The focus is mostly going to be vis-a-vis those to the left of us, other denominations, secular Jews. I think that's for two reasons. One, we had a forum in defining modern Orthodoxy where much of the conversation was vis-a-vis a more Haredi viewpoint. Secondly, simply, I think most Jewish unity questions that come up, in whether be it on a college campus, be it on the state of, in the state of Israel, tend to be more oriented towards how to deal with other denominations. So I think that that will be the focus. And I'm going to divide into two sections, one dealing with basically the problems with Jewish unity, and then the perhaps the need for Jewish unity. I'd like to start with a good quote. You know, the Commentary magazine twice had a symposium on what Jews believe, once in 1966, which was then made into a book, and once in, when was the other one, in 1996. And I think in 66 there was no question on Jewish unity, but in the 96 symposium there is a question on Jewish unity. So Rabbi Norman Lamb, former president of YU, says as follows: Jewish unity is a theme guaranteed to evoke an industrial-sized yawn. It is a chimerical nostrum. I should explain what that means. Okay, chimerical is like absurd, and nostrum is like a quack medicine. So it is a chimerical nostrum, regularly invoked by organizational drumbeaters, not an idea capable of real expression. It is best to give up the ghost and speak not of unity, but of civility, respect, and cooperation where possible. Now, let's figure out what's motivating Rabbi Lamb to, why would he call something a chimerical nostrum? What exactly is it about Jewish unity that one would refer to it as a chimerical nostrum? So here I think he is getting at something. Of course, as Rabbi Lamb put in the caveat, right, we should talk about civility and cooperation when possible. I mean, Rabbi Lamb is certainly not suggesting that his somewhat, so to speak, rejection of Jewish unity is in favor of being mean or uncivil to people or yelling at them. But yet there is a problem with Jewish unity. And the problem, I think, is really one problem, but I'll do it on two levels. One is simply we shouldn't pretend that there are no differences. The differences are real, and sometimes those real differences indicate that we really don't have a shared vision. It'd be nice to just place gloss them over and say we're really rolling it together and we have a shared vision of what it means to be Jewish. But unfortunately, this really often involves a certain amount of dishonesty. This really isn't the case. If one just go through it level by level, if one thinks about secular Jews, so if their Jewish identity is, I don't know, corned beef sandwiches and Woody Allen movies, so we don't have a shared view of the universe. Don't have a shared view of what it means to be Jewish, right? There's no glossing over that, right? Certainly Reform Jews, so, okay, here there is a certain religious commitment, but if there's no idea of a binding halakha, that seems to be a pretty big divide. This is not a minor difference that can be easily papered over. One adds to the list, let's say, something like patrilineal descent. Right, it's hard to have a more fundamental debate than who's Jewish, right? Someone comes to the room, according to us, he's not Jewish or she's not Jewish. According to them, the person is. Right? This is not something that can be easily glossed over. Even when it moves to conservative Judaism, where there is certainly in theory a notion of a binding halakha, here also I think we'll find that often we won't have a shared vision. In particular, when one recalls that often in the conservative movement, there's a large gap between the rabbinate and the laity. And Shmirat Halakha is often, again, I'm obviously generalizing here, but for the most part, Shmirat Halakha is something more practiced by the rabbinate than the laity. And then we would often find there as well that the shared vision is not so easily accomplished. So the first thing I think Rabbi Lamb is getting at here is simply that we can't pretend that we all have the same vision of what it means to be Jewish. Right? This is simply not true, and it doesn't help to pretend that it's true. But beyond that, beyond the mere acknowledgement that we don't have a shared vision, it often implies that not everything can be done together. Like, we're in favor of goodwill, we're in favor of trying to do things together, but if we think about some simple examples, it doesn't always work. I think in particular, many of you may have encountered these issues on college campuses. I think often, and this is a point I'll come back to, often on a college campus, you're forced to encounter Jews from other places, which often later in life, it's less so, right? When you're a 38-year-old lawyer, so you go to your shul and you only meet Jews from your denomination, and for the most part, you're less confronted by these questions. But those who have been confronted are probably familiar with what I'm talking about. Let's say we decide to have a joint tefillah together, right, on a Friday night Kabbalah Shabbat. It sounds really great. Till we ask the question, is there going to be a mechitza there or not? Right. Once we ask that question, all of a sudden, it becomes not so easy to figure out how we're going to have a joint tefillah together. Right. Then we will insist that this is not a principle we can compromise on. And the egalitarians, perhaps to their credit, will insist that there's not a principle that they can compromise on. And doesn't all the goodwill in the world can't necessarily overcome that divide? We would like to have Simchas Torah dancing together. So is the dancer going to be separate or mixed? Right, there's a divide that is not always able to overcome. And I realize one could say you could have three circles. It's not always obvious to me that that overcomes the divide, but I don't want to debate that right now. Let us say we choose to have a joint learning program. Right, that sounds greater, right? It's on safer ground. Right, we're not dealing with the world of Jewish ritual. But I think if we think about it often, a joint learning program brings out certain tensions also. We believe in the divinity of the Torah, right? Many, we'll use Reform, make it easy. Many Reform spokesmen will view the Torah as basically a human document, but a human document that perhaps is worthy of our respect. But I think that changes the dynamic of what's happening in learning very much so. Right, how reverentially one speaks about the tradition is going to be a split. Just use one example, perhaps it's not representative, but it's too good to pass up. There's a fellow who teaches Bible at the seminary who once in a public forum referred to the way Hashem was acting as that God is acting like a forward expletive, which I will not say what it was. But this is something, quite frankly, I'm in favor of trying to be flexible, but I don't want to appear on a program with someone who could use that kind of terminology about the Ribono Shel Olam. This is something I think that we can. There's a divide that cannot be overcome. So the first thing, the first two points I'd like to make in terms of what the problems of Jewish unity are is we shouldn't paper over the differences. Differences are quite real, and those differences will often entail not everything can be done together. I think that's the second point to keep in mind. The third point I'd like to throw in before I perhaps try to bring unity a bit back is that, and I think this is particularly prevalent in the campus world. Not sure as much elsewhere. And the campus world, especially in the world of Hillel. Right? If you ask Hillel, you stop any Hillel operative on the street and say the most word you use most frequently. If you already knows what I'm going to say. Right? Say the word you say most frequently. So the word will probably have to be pluralism. Right? Either pluralism or tolerance, I suppose. Right? Now, in that atmosphere, one's not supposed to really say that I am right and you are wrong. Now, of course, when it comes to the world of politics, that's often not the... Not the way things function, but in the world of religion, often everyone's supposed to be to each his own. But this is something that we don't really accept. Now, again, I'm not suggesting we insult other people by denigrating them, but I'm suggesting that we don't truly believe that all versions of Judaism are equally valid, and there's something that we shouldn't feel pressured into having to admit. Right? So that would be my third caveat against Jewish unity. Right? If Jewish unity means we have to claim that we view them all as valid, anyone who, as long as they are somehow, I don't know, working off Torah, the Torah text, that they are Jewish, I think we would have to reject that view. We do not have to claim that all versions of Judaism are equally valid. Okay, so perhaps that could justify the use of chimerical nostrum, though I think Dan Schlanger still would have preferred if Rabbi Lam had used simpler terminology, but at least the sentiment we can certainly appreciate. Okay, at the same time, I think many of us have a sense that, well, what about Jewish peoplehood? What about Jewish community? What about Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Lazeh? Right, where does the other side of the equation fit in? So I'd like to mention a number of levels where the other side of the equation fits in, and perhaps we'll understand, or at least help us arrive at some kind of balanced position here. I'm obviously not going to answer on a one-to-one basis, could we have this event, could we have that event, but perhaps just general guidelines. Now, the first thing to be pointed about unity is, without even bringing in what I've been discussing thus far, which is the religious ritual, the world of learning, attitudes. There's a world of unity that's not related to any of that. And this, the classic expression of, I think, is Rav Soloveitchik's Kol Dodi Dofek. Rav Soloveitchik argues that there's basically two covenants in the Jewish people, what he calls the covenant of fate and the covenant of destiny. And the covenant of fate is represented in leaving Egypt, where he argues it didn't involve that much choice on behalf of the Jewish people. We're often thrust into it together. Right? Historical forces conspire almost that the Jewish people are treated as a totality. And that means that we often have to deal with problems together. And that, Rav Soloveitchik calls the covenant of fate, right? So to speak, fate throws us into it. And there's this covenant of destiny, which is most symbolized by Matan Torah, where we freely choose to accept upon ourselves a life of Torah and mitzvot. And there, Rav Soloveitchik says, that is something that is about mitzvot. Without mitzvot, one is not a part of the covenant of destiny. Now, one of the things Rav Soloveitchik is trying to do, of course, is trying to say that we have a certain commonality with the rest of Jewry in a certain break, right? That we often will not share the covenant of destiny. We will not have a shared vision of what Jewish religious life should be. but we should share and can share the covenant of faith. Now that is manifest in many things. Arguably, if I think back to my childhood, where did the Jewish community get together? So I think back fighting for Soviet Jewish refuseniks. That was something one could be an Orthodox Jew, a conservative Jew, a Reform Jew, a secular unaffiliated Jew. Right? This is something we could all share as standing up for Jews in distress. When the state of Israel has been in danger over its history, this was often another field where there could be a sense of Jewish unity. And it seems to me this is certainly something where, despite the divide on religious matters, there's no reason why a certain kind of unified approach can be manifest in helping Jews deal with distress. That's the first thing I would say. Okay. The second thing I would say, before I get to more religious matters, is that this is really not about unity, it's just about how to function life. I mean, even assuming that what I said before, that unity is quite problematic, as I've been emphasizing many times, there's really no reason to insult anybody else gratuitously. You know, a few years back, there was this big to-do in the newspapers because some Orthodox organization that no one had ever heard of before or has heard of since, right, declared that Reform Jews aren't really Jewish. So now getting into the details of that story, whatever, it seems like it's something, a statement that really didn't accomplish anything, right? The only thing it could possibly accomplish is insult a large number of Jews and alienate them. There's really no reason to make such statements. I think this is true both vis-a-vis the outside world, even if it's our internal functioning. I've argued many times, right, if an Orthodox rabbi gets up in his modern Orthodox pulpit and is always criticizing some other group, really this is really pointless, which is, I guess, true in both directions. Right? No reason for us to get up and criticize the Haredim all the time. No reason to get up and criticize Reform and Conservative all the time. Of course, not that there's nothing to criticize, but one's essential focus in one's community should be how to fix the faults of your own community, not how to outline what's terrible about everybody else. So this is really not about unity, but simply about how we function. But the second point I would mention is, with all our criticism, that's not really that should not be our focus. We should not stay up late at night thinking about how to best criticize Reform the next day in a sermon. It is really not a good place to put our creative energies. The third point I'd like to make is something I really hinted at before, which is, I think very often in our middle-aged life in Chutz Laaretz, we're often not forced to confront this. I think very often, maybe in a smaller community, you're more forced to, I should make one caveat to this. Maybe in a larger city, you're not forced to confront it. Right? Often in larger Jewish cities, in the New Yorks and Chicagos and Los Angeles of this world, so every denomination does its thing in its own shul, and those kind of questions rarely come up. But it seems to me there are certain circumstances where they come up. I'd like to mention three, but one I really think in particular needs thinking about. One would obviously be the college campus I mentioned before. Often there, you're kind of all like eating dinner together Friday night in the Hillel. It's not so easy to say we'll all do our own thing. I think this might come up in a smaller Jewish community. I guess, I don't know how much it comes up in New Zealand, but arguably these kind of questions will come up more in New Zealand than New York. Most importantly, though, I would like to emphasize, I think, in the state of Israel. Meaning, in Chutz Laaretz, to a great degree, everyone could do their own thing. But the state of Israel, one of the great challenges of the state of Israel, and one of the great difficulties of the state of Israel, is that we have to function on a collective level. And we have to have collective policies on various things. Now, again, this does not mean that we could just sacrifice our ideals all the time, obviously not. But it does mean that the idea that we'll just all do our own thing becomes a bit more tricky. And something that requires a little bit of thought, that there might be greater flexibility needed in decision-making on a national level when it comes to the state of Israel. Okay, everything I've said thus far, though, is not really really claiming that we have a shared vision. It's just arguing we could function together when it comes to Jews in distress, Rav Soloveitchik's covenant of faith. That there's no gain to be made in insulting people gratuitously or criticizing them without need. And finally, that perhaps certain situations call for greater desire to function together than others. But perhaps there's a little bit more. Perhaps there is some elements of a shared vision. Certainly not a fully shared vision, as I gave a whole list before. The list that creates a divide is quite significant and can't be denied. Yet there might be elements of a shared vision. The shared vision might exist on ethical matters, right? Let's say we'd like to, come up with a joint statement against wife beating, right? Arguably, that's something that, irrespective of one's position on a host of other matters, we could all learn some, Rishon said you can't beat your wife, and give a whole, start a whole movement in a certain direction. Arguably, certain other things as well. Maybe certain aspects of, the beauty of a Shabbat is something that can be appreciated beyond the Orthodox world. Just to give you a couple of examples of this, one manifestation of this might be, we might have to, not have to, but we should be willing to admit that rabbis and writers from other denominations, right, might produce things that are religiously worthwhile. Right? I think there's no reason to assume that everything that is, comes from the pen of a conservative rabbi is by definition alien to Judaism. Right? Many people have found Heschel's book on the Shabbos to be the most inspiring book about Shabbos for them, without getting to whether who that's true for. But there are many Orthodox Jews who have found this to be the greatest expression of what the Shabbos is. So some of the elements of the shared vision might be there are things that we can't appreciate from those worlds. Even, I would argue, even to the extent of not necessarily rejecting all the critiques that they're saying about us, which again, many of their critiques are often gratuitous, and often there's a tolerance that only goes to people to the left of you, not to people to the right of you. But at the same time, some of their critiques might be right on the money. Right? And if, let's say during a given year, there's too many, a couple of scandals in the Orthodox world, and say lying about how many students you have in your elementary school to get money from the government, and let's say we're criticized by this by secular Jews, so it could be our impulse would be to lash back, but maybe sometimes we have to think, you know, their criticisms might have some validity to it, even from our own worldview, even from our own perspective, there might be some truth to those criticisms. To move on to three more things, and I'll try to wrap it up here. Just in terms of how we think about this world, we'll go to another symposium. Okay, there's in the second volume of Rav Lichtenstein's Leaves of Faith, there's a number of symposiums there. So in one of the symposiums, he's asked about the other denominations. So he says as follows. Nor do I share the glee some feel over the prospective demise of the competition. Surely we have many sharp differences with the conservative and reform movements, and these should not be sloughed over or blurred. However, we also share many values with them. And this too should not be obscured. Their disappearance might strengthen us in some respects, but would unquestionably weaken us in others. And of course, if we transcend our own interests and think of the people currently served by these movements, many of them, both presently and potentially, well beyond our reach or ken, how would they or Klal Yisrael as a whole be affected by such a change? Can anyone reasonably state that it is better for a marginal Jew in Dallas or in Dubuque to lose his religious identity altogether rather than drive to his temple? Well, you see, Rav Lichtenstein, he can't resist the alliteration even in picking two cities. But here I think Rav Lichtenstein is making an important point, which is often we think like we cheer on like the struggles of conservative and reform Jewry sometimes. But you have to ask, like, what's the alternative? Like, if they die, would all those people like immediately become Orthodox? I think an honest assessment of the situation would have to admit that for the overwhelming majority of them, the alternative would be a secular Jewish identity. And from that perspective, to the degree that these movements connect people to Shabbat or learning Torah or the like, that this is something that we should view as a positive development. So this, I think, also in terms of how we think about the other movements, there's something to be kept in mind. Right? Is it something really to cheer on their demise, or is it something to... perhaps it's really good for us that they do exist on some level. This leads me to really my last point, then I'll try to wrap it up, which is as follows. I think also one has to think about what the challenge of the day is. And I would argue over the course of the last 200 years, there have been radical shifts in, so to speak, where the challenge to Orthodox life lies. I'd like to argue about three stages. It seems to me if one lived in the 1850s in Europe, then the challenge of emancipation was often, say, the desire to join Christian society. Like the famous Jewish writer who said that baptism was his ticket to the Western world. Right, so that was often the challenge, let's say, 1852 Prussia. Right. If one moves to the beginning of the 20th century in America, I think often Orthodoxy felt that it was losing out to the other denominations. Right? It's well known that all the Jewish sociologists of the first half century of the 20th century in Jewish life in America said clearly conservative and reform are the wave of the future, and Orthodoxy is basically just a dying movement. Now clearly those sociologists have been proven wrong, but I would argue that in a contemporary situation, our biggest opponent is not other religions, nor is it other denominations. It is simply secular materialism. And I think if we think about the people we know who've abandoned Orthodoxy, I unfortunately know of considerable list of people who've done so. I cannot think of one who settled on another denomination as a result. It seems to me the usual movement away from Orthodoxy in contemporary society would be towards some kind of secular American or secular Western Jewish identity. And from that perspective, I think in different times, based on what the opposition is, that might impact on how harsh a stance you take. Like, would we feel that we're essentially losing out to conservative Jewry? We might feel a need to draw more red lines and make more speeches and the like. If we feel that the real challenge is a totally secular worldview, so from that perspective, to some degree, not totally, but to some degree, the conservative Jewish movement is our ally, right? To the degree that it stands for a certain religious message and not a purely materialistic secular message. So it's something else to take into consideration. Now, this could impact on a lot of practical decisions. And here, just to discuss practicality for 1 minute, although I'm really not going to... It's hard to give any practical guidance because everything is so dependent on its given context. But let's just give one practical example where some of these tensions come into play. Like many of you know, there's a very popular learning program in England called Limud, in which Jews from different denominations come to learn, and Jews from different denominations come to teach. Now, the Orthodox rabbi in England has taken a very harsh stance against participating in this. And they are mostly concerned about granting recognition to, the rabbis and teachers from the other movements. And here are something I would argue that, on the one hand, it's not a crazy thought. On the other hand, there's a tremendous missed opportunity here, right? Especially if we believe, which I do believe quite strongly, we've got a good product, if you excuse the business imagery, right? This I'll be very curious to hear what Rabbi Bravender says to this, but I remember Rabbi Bravender phrased this quite sharply once. You know, someone, let's say, I'll be a little bit unfair. Let's say someone else gets up and gives some talk about how Judaism is the exact same as Buddhism, right, if you really understand it. And we get up and teach a tremendously profound Ramban. So I would argue that the Ramban will win, right? That is a product that should be out there in the marketplace. Right, and this is a chance to be exposed, to expose these ideas to the broader Jewish world. And it's a missed opportunity to not be present there. Now, this is where the previous point I may think comes in. To the degree that we would view the other denominations as the challenge of the day, we might be more interested in being very careful. Don't give them any credence. Don't do anything that might grant them any legitimacy. If, on the other hand, we think they're not the challenge of the day, and the challenge of the day is elsewhere, so it could be there in the balance of factors, we might say, you know, let's give our Torah a chance, right? Let's go to these places and speak, and we'll see. Maybe we could attract people to an Orthodox way of life. So just to sum up, I realize in a certain sense I haven't given direct practical guidance, but I think, you know, a lot of these issues is getting a sense of the values and the balances involved. And here I think this is really the balances we have to think about. Again, not to pretend there are no differences, not to pretend the differences aren't significant, not to pretend we can do everything together. Sometimes we have to draw lines. I'm very sorry, we can't do it together, right? Not to pretend that we have to claim that all approaches to Judaism are equally valid. There's no reason why we should be forced into that position. At the same time, we should remember all the other things that we've talked about here, right? The need to help Jews in danger, the need to behave civilly, particularly the pressures of modern Israel towards some kind of communal functioning, the elements of a shared vision that we do have, the fact that these movements are better than secularism, and for us it's probably good for the Jewish people that they exist. And as I said, really, to realize what the current struggle is. It seems to me that the struggle of our day is most pronounced against secular materialism, not against the other denominations. I will now turn you to the floor to Rabbi Bravender.
I think I agree with everything that Rabbi Bloch said, except for one thing. What I said was, basket weaving cannot win against Torah. That's the Limud story. I think that that what Rabbi Bloch was discussing was the politics of Jewish existence, and that we all agree that it's very important to keep the fire burning, whatever fire it is that we've lit. I guess that's the connection to Lag BaOmer. And on the other hand, to recognize the fact that even Jews who, especially in our generation, when there are many Jews who don't have a Jewish education, who have not been benefited from the generations of connections to the kind of Torah and Jewish perspective that I think is, for example, that I think is proper, that those Jews certainly don't deserve to be ignored, denied, avoided, even maybe as perhaps Rav Aaron intimated, that the conservative movement, even though it's a movement and is an organization and has ideals, may nevertheless, from our point of view, be doing good things for the Jewish community, Bechlau. For I would say, if all those Jews had no way to connect themselves to their Judaism, then it would be worse. And if you put a big Orthodox shul in Des Moines, Iowa, maybe nothing would happen. Maybe they need a reform shul. I mean, one can come up with all these kinds of. I mean, all of these things I think are correct. On the other hand, it's not really unity unless there is some sort of a shared vision. Unless people who are different from each other can become excited about their Judaism and somehow move themselves in a particular direction, I would say, that is a better definition of unity than the absence of diversity. So you know that sometimes, if there's a city, if you live in a city and they don't collect the garbage as frequently as you think they should, so then you can get together with all the people who live in the city and try to get garbage collected more often, and if you're good about it, you'll be successful. If the city decides not to allow some Lubavitcher guy to light a Hanukkah menorah in the middle of the street, it happened in a couple of cities. I'm always amazed to discover that there are mayors of cities in America who are not afraid of Lubavitch. But apparently this took place. So all the Jews could come to the conclusion that this is a matter for a bipartisan response, that actually it's not an anti-Lubavitch act, which most Jews or many Jews would think is not so bad, but it's really anti-Jewish. Okay, anti-Jewish. You can work together to stave off what you perceive as being anti-Jewish, which is not anti-Orthodox or anti-conservative or anti-independent kind of Jew. So you can get excited. You get excited about things. But these are things that come and go. They come up, and then they disappear. And they're gone, so that the notion of unity, if they're like such a thing, which means being passionate about something together, right? In other words, when you daven mincha erev Yom HaKippurit, so the people who are davening mincha together are together often. I mean, maybe I'm romanticizing. Often, I mean, it's a time that everybody who is doing that particular act is together. It seems to me that that's closer to the notion of unity that we seek. What is there, and other than the occasional act that somebody does, which is perceived as being anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic, what is there in the world, in the universe, about which all the Jews, irrespective of the way they define themselves as Jews, can be passionate about? I said, if we could discover that, I think we'd have another definition of unity besides just being polite or you know, not annoying each other, which is very much in the modern, you know, the modern vision. I told you that the new level of the great thing in America is that you can have a business lunch in a kosher restaurant, right? The great thing about that is that the non-Jew doesn't know that he's necessarily eating in a kosher restaurant, because the food is food. I mean, it's good food. It's not Jewish food. It's not like corned beef, fatty corned beef. Right? It's not like that. It's like really whatever people think good food is, not having eaten in any non-kosher restaurants. I can't tell you what that is, but they say all the non-Jews who are eating in the kosher restaurants, it is just fine, you know. It's food. They think it's food. So for me, it's avara. It must be food. So the only thing that's annoying is that these kosher restaurants usually say on the menu that they're kosher. So that the non-Jews like are confronted by this puzzle. They say, I thought this was a restaurant. What is kosher? Like, what does that do? So they have now opened a kosher restaurant in New York, which has a very highly regarded hechsher, but it doesn't say kosher in the restaurant. In other words, you can take your non-Jewish friend to that restaurant and sort of have him think that he's in a non-Jewish restaurant. Well, see, it'd be hard for you to explain why all these people wearing yarmulkes are also in the restaurant. But, you know, it's a kind of a perception. It's a kind of a kind of perception. So what is it that we could do? Like, where's the unity? Where's the unity that the Jewish people, that Am Yisrael can get passionate, to get passionate about? I think my opinion is that the only option that exists since we've gone our separate ways on life, on halacha, on education, I mean, and I don't think that in any of these areas that there's a tremendous amount of movement in one direction or the other. But I can't say that since 1967, which I always think was the beginning of the Baal Tshuva movement, that the numbers of Jews who are shomer mitzvahs because of the Baal Tshuva movement has been overwhelming. Because as many people in the last 30 or 40 years have become Baal Tshuva, there are many, and they are wonderful people, of course. A lot of people who were in the movement, who received an Orthodox Jewish education, have left. So it's not education, it's not the shuls are not going to change. I think the only thing, and we haven't figured out how to do it, but the only thing about which Am Yisrael can be passionate in a kind of unified manner, where the unified passion has value in a way that disunity would not have passion, is the state of Israel. But in order for the state of Israel to become the object of passion for Jews in the world, they have to understand something about the state of Israel that makes it worthy of passion, which is not the case. Because the way we try to do it, I mean, the way it's done today is you take people from, say, America or Western Europe, and you put them on a plane, right? Now, the plane is exactly the same as any other plane they've ever been on. They land in Israel, they get on a bus, and the bus is exactly the same as every other bus they've ever been on. And the bus takes them to a hotel. And the hotel is exactly the same as every hotel that they've ever been in. In fact, they haven't met a single person yet who's willing to speak to them in Hebrew. Right? You know, you go up to anybody in Israel and you say, Slicha, they start talking in English. Right? So it's like almost it's a key. It's a key. Like they say, look, we know how to speak Hebrew. We were born here. But really, we speak English. Really, we speak English. Then they take them on tours. They go on tours. Every tour is, here is the biggest, here is the best, here's something that the only time in history, this is the greatest thing there was. I mean, it's like a tour. And then lunch, air conditioned, back to the hotel, sauna, swimming, yes sir. In other words, our whole educational format is, well, Israel is exactly the same as Tinek. In fact, if you want on the tour, we'll put in Ranana, and then you'll meet all the people who came from Tinek. And so Israel I mean, the Israeli, I mean, I'm not saying it's a criticism. I mean, I understand it. The Israelis, it seems to me, want to be Americans. If the Gzeirah, if there's some edict from heaven that obligates them to live in the Middle East, that's not going to stop them. They'll live in the Middle East, they'll be Americans. So Americans, Englishmen, Frenchmen, I mean, you know, people come to Israel. They say, well, this is great. All the signs are in English. Everybody speaks in English. The food is exactly the same food as I get at home. There's no difference. Everything is, it's great. It's great. When does the plane go back? In other words, the only way we can generate passion about the state of Israel in people outside the state of Israel is to claim that the state of Israel is about to be destroyed. That's all there is. There is no, because the state of Israel is not about to be destroyed. Then it's just another great place, you know. I mean, do you like it better than Englewood? Than Teaneck? Okay. You don't like it? Also okay. I mean, what's the difference? You can have somebody, can you imagine people fighting about whether to live in Englewood or living in Teaneck? Can't imagine that either. So that Israel, in order to create passion in the Jewish world, the kind of passion that would produce unity, meaning that the greater good for each person in that group is certainly this project or this issue that they undertake. The way for Israel to create that is to say what it's not willing to say, that we are essentially different. That Israel is not another place that Jews are living, but it has created a unique kind of option, and that the existence of the Jewish people in some way has become dependent, I won't go into that now, but has become dependent on that option. So that the existence of the state of Israel is not just a question of, not a question of will they exist, won't they exist. It's become a question of existence for the Jewish people. I remember the Rabbi Soloveitchik in that famous interview, I think I mentioned it once, that Elie Wiesel was a stringer for Ma'ariv in the 50s. He lived in New York, but he lived in Israel for a while, so he learned how to write Hebrew. So he wrote for Ma'ariv. He worked for Ma'ariv in New York. He interviewed Rabbi Soloveitchik when it came up, when becoming the chief rabbi of Israel came up. So Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't take the nod. And so they talked about Israel in this interview. It's a very interesting interview. So anyway, one of the things Rabbi Soloveitchik said was, you know, there's always this discussion about whether the state of Israel has halachic standing or doesn't have halachic standing, you know, like it's so strange. I'll leave that out. That's for a different time. Well, I find it very strange. So he said, look, in the state of Israel, everything changes. Because the Jewish people have developed a new kind of pride. This new kind of attitude that they have about themselves. And that also is true about the reason that Lag BaOmer became a secular holiday. You know that in Israel, Lag BaOmer is a secular holiday. It's a secular holiday. Because if I ran a cheder, if I had little kids, they would all go to cheder on Lag BaOmer. What kind of holiday is Lag BaOmer? Do you ever hear of a cheder? A cheder in Europe, in Plonsk or Chvezvos, they say, don't come to school on Lag BaOmer. Never heard of such a thing. What's Lag BaOmer? You say, there's a malacha on Lag BaOmer. You say, halal. What? You have to eat sudos. What's Lag BaOmer? What is it? You have to go Krich HaRayin in the Shulchan Aruch to find where it says you don't say Tachnun. Right? Lag BaOmer, you don't say Tachnun. So Lag BaOmer is a secular holiday in Israel. They invented it. So now the psychologists say, I don't know if this is right, but I'm just saying it over to have something to say. The psychologists say that when people came to Israel, their self-image was poor. Because they just got through the Holocaust and they felt not ennobled, but enfeebled. Like, would they make it? Would they be able to do it? So they needed heroes. They needed a few Jewish heroes. Gechapt bar kochva. Right? Because in those days, there were Jews who were not religious, who knew something about the sources. Thankfully, that has changed. But today, non-religious Jews in Israel don't know anything, which is also part of the problem. Right? It's part of the problem with, you know, with tourists come from America to Israel, and they say, what to their tour guide, what time is Shabbos? And he says, oh, Shabbos is tomorrow. You know, so they get a little discouraged by that. So little by little, they teach the tour guides what the answers to certain key questions are, you know. You remember, you don't remember when that when Yitzhak Rabin became the ambassador to America. This is a Rabin who was a great hero of the Jews, the Jewish people who live in Israel. He became ambassador, Israeli ambassador in America. So, of course, what did he do? Like, you know, he was there from Sunday to Friday. They came Shabbos. So they said, what do you do? I mean, it was Saturday also. So he didn't work. So what do you do? So somebody told him to go to shul. So he went to shul in Georgetown. He went to shul. And they were so excited. They were so excited to see him. You know, the ambassador, Israel ambassador, Israel. They wanted to give him an aliyah. So some guy, you know, the gabbai, comes over to you and he says, what's your name? And he said, Yitzchak. And so the gabbai said, no, but what's your name? Yitzchak. And then another time they said, Yitzchak Rabin. So now in the course that they give to ambassadors who go to Chutz La'aretz, they have shul. You know, because they figured out that you could not go to shul in Israel, but you can't not go to shul in America. Right? Impossible. So there's a... How do I get to Yitzhak Rabin? Bar Kochva. So Bar Kochva was a hero. Bar Kochva was a hero. I mean, like, you could debate that. I mean, after all, he lost. He didn't only lose. He lost the whole pot of gold. I mean, the Romans, they just kicked everybody out. There's nothing less. That was Bar Kochva. But he was a hero because he got together an army and he trained them and they all pulled these tree stumps out of the ground. I don't know how they did that. I wondered about that. They cut off their thumbs. I mean, you know, they were heroic. They were strong-minded people. Like people, like you go into the gym and there are these guys who are lifting 400 kilo, you know. Those guys are heroes. You don't want to talk to them, but they're... So that was Bar Kochva. So they made a secular holiday in Israel. And they called it Lag BaOmer. They didn't call it Lag BaOmer, but it was Lag BaOmer. It was the holiday of Bar Kochva. It was the holiday of Bar Kochva. Today what happened was they had all of this, this tremendous aliyah from the eastern countries, where they thought that Bar Kochva was like another name for Shimon ben Yochai, and they got the whole thing. They took over, right? So it sounds like, to us, it sounds like Lag BaOmer is a religious holiday, but the reason that children don't go to school on Lag BaOmer in Israel is because it's a secular holiday, not because it's a religious holiday. And that secular holiday was, it disappeared, but it's an interesting thing. I mean, that's the history. And besides, it's Lag BaOmer, so I have to tell you something about Lag BaOmer. So that Israel is the hope. But Israel is also the problem. Unity is possible for the Jewish people only if they find something to be passionate about. And the only thing that exists that I can see that there might be a subject or an object of passion is the state of Israel. But in order to be passionate about the state of Israel, you have to see it as a dream. It has to be something that is so wonderful in potential that you can't even imagine not having it once that potential exists. It's not a halachic issue, to my mind, because after all, many great halachists don't see it as such. And it's not a matter of self-defense or because it seems that Israel is very strong and will be able to take care of itself. But for the Jewish people, it could possibly become a dream. And if it's a dream for the Jewish people, then making that dream come true could become the passionate interest of those people. So unity, I mean, if that's what we're talking about, I think is the ability to see something greater than my self-interest. I do have a lot of self-interest. And my self-interest, I feel, at least, is justified. And whether I do something or I don't do something, I mean, the two sides to the question are always difficult to debate and to decide about. However, it is possible in Am Yisrael for there to be a dream. I think that this was the problem with Yetzias Mitzrayim. At the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, Moshe Rabbeinu said to Bnei Yisrael, look, you have to have the dream of Eretz Yisrael. You can't just look at what there is. But you have to see in your mind's eye pretty clearly what might be. And that was Moshe Rabbeinu went up on the mountain and he looked and he said, let me into Eretz Yisrael, because he saw the dream. And he said, that's where I want to be. Not because it was there now. It's true, there were cities, and they had walls, and there were bad people, and they were accomplished, less accomplished, more accomplished, people who were nice to each other, people who weren't nice to each other, the spies, the Meraglim said, what do we need it for? What do we need the interaction for? I mean, what good will come of it? Let's stay here in the desert. Let's stay here in the desert where we have a Mishkan, and the Mishkan is in the midst. It's mamish in the midst. It's not like an Eretz Yisrael if you live in the Galil. You don't see Yerushalayim. But they were in the desert. They saw the Mishkan wherever they were. Wherever they stood, they were right next to the Mishkan. Why would you want to go to Eretz Yisrael? So Moshe Rabbeinu said to them, you need a dream. And the dream has to be what we are unified around. I think that Eretz Yisrael could be that dream. But I recognize the fact that there are difficulties. We are difficult. We're a difficult community, we who live in Eretz Yisrael, in convincing anybody that we're dreaming. And therefore, the people who come to Eretz Yisrael have a difficult time in seeing us as the fulfillment of a dream. Nevertheless, it's possible. Semeglach. You know, it could be. Because Eretz Yisrael, at the end of the day, doesn't make so much sense. It's difficult to understand how this happened, what caused it, how in such a short time it turned into whatever it turned into, which is really a grand thing. And that if we could just work at that, I think we could come up with something that approximates a dream which would deserve the attention of the unified Klal Yisrael. Have a good day.